Yeah, thank you for your welcome. It's always a joy to be with you and good to reconnect. Thanks for the prayers that many of you have prayed for us in our ministry in Derby and in Radstock more widely. We really do appreciate your interest and prayers. And for some of you, especially in the recent times, we've had a bit of a hard season in our own family lives. And some of you have been in contact and encouraged us in that. And that we really appreciate that. So thank you, and great that you're sending out Becky. That's so exciting that she's been out in Macedonia and is talking about other options in the future. It's really encouraging to see churches that have a mindset to send and to be involved in global missions. So we really do appreciate that. I'm planning on being around this afternoon at the cookout, which will be nice to be able to catch up with some more of you individually to chat some more. I've been here for just over 2 weeks now. This is my third Sunday here. Yesterday and the last 2 days I've been at the Radstock US Forum, which has been in Michigan. So we've done that for the last 2 days. Flew in to DC last night, delayed flight, didn't get in until 1:30. I'm a little bit sleepy after everything that's going on, but we'll plow on anyway. I don't know if you ever heard of the preacher who dreamt that he was preaching and woke up to discover that he was. Well, I feel like that could be me this morning, potentially. So if that happens, just give me a nudge, be gentle with me, and we'll keep on going. We're going to look this morning at Mark's Gospel as we continue the series that you've been in for a number of weeks now. And if you find Mark chapter 6 in your Bibles or on your device, and we're going to read from verse 45 down to the end of the chapter. So Mark chapter 6, verse 45, immediately Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, to Bethsaida, while he dismissed the crowd. And after he had taken leave of them, he went up on the mountain to pray. And when evening came, the boat was out on the sea, and he was alone on the land. And he saw that they were making headway painfully, for the wind was against them. And about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. He meant to pass by them, but when they saw him walking on the sea, they thought it was a ghost and cried out, for they all saw him and were terrified. But immediately he spoke to them and said, "Take heart, it is I, do not be afraid." And he got into the boat with them, and the wind ceased. And they were utterly astounded, for they did not understand about the loaves, but their hearts were hardened. When they'd crossed over, they came to the land at Gennesaret, and moored to the shore. And when they got out of the boat, the people immediately recognized him and ran about the whole region and began to bring the sick people on their beds to wherever they heard he was. And wherever he came, in villages, cities, or countryside, they laid the sick in the marketplaces and implored him that they might touch even the fringe of his garment. And as many as touched it were made well. Well, one of the more surreal experiences of my life was several years ago when I was sitting in a small military hut with some soldiers. A lot of you are military, right? I'm not. But on this occasion, I was sitting in a small military hut with some Pakistani soldiers in Kashmir, Pakistan-controlled Kashmir, not too far from the line of control with Indian-controlled Kashmir. And these soldiers were making us chai, and showing us their weapons, which I'm not entirely sure they should have been, to be honest, but I think they were a bit bored. And we were sitting together, drinking chai and telling stories. My friend, who was with me, enjoys telling stories, and so he volunteered a story. He told a story, a Mullah Nasruddin story. Now, Mullah Nasruddin, I don't know if you've heard of him, is a kind of folktale character in a number of Islamic countries. And these stories, they're almost like Aesop's fables. And so my friend told a story, and it goes like this. Once upon a time, Mullah Nasruddin came up with a successful way of making a living. And the successful way of making a living was smuggling. Each week, he crossed the border between Persia and Greece with a number of donkeys and a large bale of straw on each. And as he crossed the border, the customs officials would go through everything. And when they looked at it, they could only ever find straw. That was all they could find. And yet, Mullah Nasruddin was getting richer and richer all the time. And everybody knew it. And so week by week, the customs officials became more desperate to find something. They knew something was going on, but they always failed. Many years later, so the story goes, Mullah Nasruddin retired to Egypt. And one of the former customs officials looked him up and said, "Hey, Mullah Nasruddin, you know, we know you were smuggling something all those years ago between Persia and Greece. Now that that's ancient history and, you know, you've retired and you're here and I've stopped work, can't you tell me what it was?" "Yes, my friend," said Mullah Nasruddin. "Now you are free of your responsibilities, I can tell you. I was smuggling..." What? You can tell I'm in FBI territory. Yeah, donkeys. He was smuggling donkeys. Now, I tell you that story because it's a good story, and it's a story with a message about the way that we as human beings can sometimes miss what is right in front of our eyes, can't we? Now, sometimes that might be down to what is sometimes known as having a man look, as my wife would put it, you know, missing the blindingly obvious. But it isn't just a man thing. Sometimes we all miss what is obvious. And why is that? How does that happen? How is it that the customs officials could miss the donkeys? Because, you know, they could see them. It's not that they were invisible. They could see the donkeys. But there were prior assumptions about what kinds of things they expected Mullah Nasruddin to be smuggling. So without even realizing it, the official had dismissed certain possibilities. He dismissed the possibility that he could be smuggling donkeys, and those assumptions met. He wasn't looking at the situation objectively. He wasn't neutral. His vision was distorted. You know, when we look at many situations in life, we can do something similar. In all kinds of ways, we might think that a certain person couldn't do that or be this. We might think about how they look or speak or act. We might think a certain situation couldn't unfold in a certain way. And we sometimes do that because of our prior assumptions. We certainly do this when it comes to seeing spiritual realities. And as your series is entitled, Seeing Jesus with Transformed Eyes, we can struggle to see with clear spiritual sight because of the assumptions we have. Now, these struggles may vary from generation to generation and from culture to culture, but a number of them are remarkably consistent. And one of those is the way that we can struggle to see past the material world. We can struggle to see past that because, well, you know, it's just so real, isn't it? It's right there in front of us all the time. And sometimes, if we're honest, to talk about the unseen God, about a kingdom that's not of this world, unseen spiritual powers that do battle with God and his kingdom, following a king who we cannot see with our physical eyes, these things can be a stretch to really grasp as reality when we have this person or this situation, this reality in front of our eyes. There might be an activity or an opportunity, some scenario, a temptation, a friend, an antagonist, the boss, the kids, the clutter, whatever. It just seems so real because it's here and it's now, and seeing beyond it can be hard. In this account from Mark's Gospel, we're going to see how the disciples, these followers of Jesus, had something of the same issues in this regard, because it's part of the human condition. So we're going to see something of that human condition and also see how, through this, the person of Christ became clearer to them. So looking, first of all, then, at the human condition. Let's get into the story and see something of what's going on in the narrative here. This is coming straight on the heels of the feeding of the 5,000, which, of course, was probably something more like the feeding of the 25,000, because the 5,000 was only counting the men. So it was 5,000 family units, if you like, rather than individuals. And as we get into verse 45, where our passage starts, Jesus is plainly hurrying the disciples out of there. You can see that in verse 45? Immediately, he made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he dismissed the crowd. It seems a little bit odd in some ways. You know, he's rushing them. "Come on, people, let's go. Scram. Get in the boat. Get out of here." And I think one of the issues to understand is something of the nature of this moment in the unfolding ministry of Jesus. See, at this time, people are loving him, aren't they, in many ways. He's Mr. Popular. The crowds are chasing him. But they lack any real understanding of who he is or why he's come. And of course, those are the two issues that Mark's gospel has been written to deal with, aren't they? Who is he in chapter 1 down to 8, verse 29? And then why did he come from the end of chapter 8 to 16? Who is he and why did he come? And we're still in the first half here, aren't we? This question is not yet resolved. And we're approaching the great confession of Simon Peter, which functions as the hinge between those two halves, but we're not there yet. The who is he question is still live. And at this point in the unfolding drama, it's a real danger point. You know the saying that a little knowledge is a dangerous thing? Well, here, the crowds, the disciples, they're increasingly aware that Jesus is more than an ordinary rabbi. He has unusual authority. He has amazing power. And people are beginning to think maybe he could be the Messiah. And they're not wrong. But they are in danger of heading off with that in completely the wrong direction. Because if you think, what were the issues that confronted them in front of their eyes? What was the material reality in front of them? What fed their assumptions about life and reality? What did they perceive as their greatest need? Every day, as members of the Jewish community, they awoke to the harsh realities of living in an occupied land, being second-class citizens in their own country, of Roman oppression and brutality, of being taxed within an inch of their lives to keep Caesar and his cohort in the lifestyle they'd been used to. They were abused and they were beaten and they were afraid every single day. That was their reality. And so what would a potential Messiah do? He's going to raid Rome and kick them into touch, obviously. He's going to be a warrior. He's going to overthrow the oppressor. They understand something, but a little knowledge and understanding can be a dangerous thing. And this is a crunch moment where it could all go very wrong in terms of Jesus' mission. It's central to the mission of God in our world is the coming of the Messiah and the world's understanding of who he is, to believe in him, to have our lives and our communities transformed by him. And people all over the world in every nation need this. That's why we're involved in missions in different ways. That's why you guys are involved in missions in so many different ways. It's why you plant churches. It's why we're gathered today. The life and death and resurrection of Jesus is the hope of the world. It heals brokenness, forgives sin, makes all things new. And that mission is in danger of running off the tracks here if people get this and run off with it in the wrong direction. I think that's surely why Jesus withdraws to pray, is it not, at this moment? I mean, Jesus clearly lived a life of prayer anyway, but the Gospels do note particular times when he would withdraw for an extended time away from the others to be refreshed, to do business with his Father, receive strength and perspective and insight. Good things, by the way, for all of us to do, to follow his example in. To take time regularly to pull away, particularly when there's big stuff going on, and sit quietly with our Lord and talk to him, receive refreshment and strength and perspective. But back to these disciples, it seems Jesus is dragging them out of there. Get on the boat, quick. Before they say too much, maybe reveal what they know, whip the crowds up even more, feed the euphoria. He's trying to contain the situation. Get in the boat, I'll follow later. He doesn't actually say how he's going to follow later at this point, but he says, I'll follow later. Off you go. Now, remember, several of these guys are fishermen, okay? So to hop into a boat and to get across to the other side, about 8 miles, is no big deal. Except this time, it says, well, all it actually says is the wind was against them. I mean, we say that if you're walking down a street and it's blowing a little bit hard. I think we can take it was a little bit more than that, because they're still out there, it says, at the fourth watch of the night in verse 48. And so if they left the feeding of the 5,000 fairly promptly and it was early evening, the fourth watch is somewhere between 3 a.m. and 6 a.m. So to say in verse 48 that they're making headway painfully is also Mark being kind of to the point. It's almost like British understatement, isn't it? I've got to admit. You know, there was a little bit of a breeze. They were in a tricky spot. This was a strong wind blowing them way off course, so that a journey that should have taken, I'm not sure, maybe an hour or so, appears to be taking 9 hours or more. And they must have been exhausted, mustn't they? And it's helpful to remember, too, how beyond any fears that any of us might have in that kind of situation, ancient cultures, and particularly Jewish culture, saw the water, saw the seas in a certain way. It was a place of chaos. It was a place where you were at the mercy of the elements. Open water has a power, like almost nothing else in our world. Last week, I was in Canada and saw the Niagara Falls for the first time, and then also went up to see the Kakabeka Falls in northern Ontario, where I have some family. And, you know, you just stand there, and the amount of water pouring over that cliff edge, those cliff edges, is phenomenal. The power is humbling and not a little frightening. In the context of the open sea, with winds added in, and the darkness as well, we're talking about chaos, confusion, danger, helplessness. They're exhausted, they're stressed, they're afraid, and then add into the mix, they see someone walking towards them on the water, and they think it's a ghost. Verse 49, they cry out. They're scared. They're really scared. Grown, experienced fishermen screaming. The word for ghost is phantasma, where we get the word phantom from, you know, like the Phantom of the Opera. And the words of the famous song from that capture something of their experience, actually. Nighttime sharpens, heightens each sensation. Darkness stirs and wakes imagination. Silently the senses abandon their defenses. Da-da-da-da-da-da, the music of the night. I'm not singing it. They're afraid. What they see in front of them is beyond their ability to process, and they are afraid. It plays into all of their fears. And as one guy put it, fear is the first cousin of unbelief. It's not a huge jump to get from one to the other. It's not necessary. It's not the same thing, but it's not a huge jump to get from one to the other. And life is like that sometimes, isn't it? Events unfold in unexpected ways. We feel out of control, overwhelmed. Sometimes the waves come and they just seem to keep coming, and it's relentless. And you barely recovered from the last one, and another one comes. And it feels chaotic, dark, frightening. Out of control. We're uncertain as to where life's going. It's too much to process. And, well, many of us know where our minds can get to at 4 a.m. in the dark hours. Fear is the first cousin of unbelief. It's a danger zone. Fear grips us, it overwhelms us, and it can sink us if we give in to the despair, if we do not believe there is any hope. We can feel hope is gone, God is distant, absent, or unreal. And so down the downward spiral we go. Now, how did the disciples get to this point? Why were they so afraid, and why didn't they recognize Jesus? Now, the explanation that the passage gives is weird at first reading, actually. But it explains a lot when you get your head around it. So it says in verse 52, they were utterly astounded, for they did not understand about the loaves, but their hearts were hardened. And you think, they didn't understand about the loaves. What's the connection there? Somehow this reaction in the boat is related to the events of the previous evening when Jesus rushed them off, got them out of the situation. And we said, didn't we, he was managing the situation because their hearts were still not really fully receptive. They were still not understanding. But the loaves, what does that mean? Perhaps one way to put it is to say that the eyes of their heart were in the wrong place. So when the loaves and the fish were distributed, miraculously, they didn't primarily see the presence of God. What they saw was the presence of food. And when they looked at Jesus, they didn't yet see him clearly either. They saw the potential presence of a liberator, a warrior, or a food provider, all of which were kind of true, but their hearts were not soft to see deeper. They were not yet malleable enough. Their sight, their understanding, their presuppositions, their assumptions, they were forming like calluses around their hearts such that they weren't open to the bigger, more glorious realities. They couldn't see the wood for the trees. They couldn't see the donkeys being smuggled, even though the truth was in plain sight. That's the human condition. That's our need of Jesus right there. Life happens, doesn't it? As it has a habit of doing. Sometimes it's overwhelming, sometimes it's exciting, But the processor that we put it all through is full of fallen presuppositions about the nature of God, about who Jesus is, about our own priorities and needs, where power really lies in our world generally, and perhaps in our own little ecosystems around us more locally. And these kind of assumptions can have a hardening effect on our hearts. And the longer we go on, the harder our hearts can become. That's the human condition. And it takes a miracle of transformed vision to be able to see, to have the spiritual sight we need, to break the cycle. We need this, all of us, just as these first apprentices of Jesus did. So, let's keep going, see more of who Jesus is, and see how he makes a difference to our spiritual sight and our hardened hearts. We've thought about the human condition, but let's think about the person of Christ and how that's revealed here. Because there's a lot going on. This is cleverly written and constructed material. We've already mentioned how the book is structured carefully to lead us on a journey about who Jesus is and then why he came. But there's another element of the construction of this gospel, which is the way that it images and it references other bits of the Bible. So they've told the story and they kind of dropped it into the much bigger story of the whole Bible. You know the way a musician might kind of use a short riff that has an echo of another song? Or a dance track, you know, samples something. Or there's a throwback reference in some poetical work. Storytellers do it too. And these gospel writers record this story of Christ and they weave it into the bigger story and echo certain themes. And Jesus was entirely self-conscious in playing to that, actually, in some of the things that he did. And so when we come to the question of understanding about the loaves, we need to grasp some of the Old Testament echoes in the feeding of the 5,000. Now, there's different ways you can look at that. There's a number of different echoes you could pick up on. But one of them is, you know, you've got a bunch of people, a large crowd of people, seated on a plain. They're sat in groups. And then distributed to them is a miraculous source of food that meets their needs. I think one of the things that's meant to make us think of is the occasion in the wilderness with Moses gathering the Israelites in the desert and the manna coming, the Lord providing for his people. And that can resonate in a couple of ways. There's obviously the angle of divine provision from the Lord under the leadership of Moses in Exodus 16, but there's also the idea in Deuteronomy 18 that just that there will come another Moses-like person. It talks in Deuteronomy 18 about a prophet like Moses who will one day come. That is a classic Old Testament hope. I was once sitting on a plane next to a Muslim guy who spent most of the flight sitting next to me. He was from coming back from Pakistan to the UK. He was questioning me and trying to persuade me of the truth of Islam. And we had a nice conversation all the way back. It was a long conversation because it's a long journey. And he just went, apart from when I pretended to be asleep, the conversation went on the whole time. And he said to me at one point, did I know that the Old Testament talks about Muhammad? Now, you may know that this is something that Muslims do believe. Some of my Muslim friends near where I live, we've talked about this. And this is the reference that they use. They say that Muhammad is the prophet like Moses. They say he's more like him than Jesus is. You know, he had a mother and a father. He was married. He had children and so on. There's more correlation there. I said, well, yeah, we don't think that. We understand that to be Jesus. And particularly in his role as the provider and sustainer of his people. And he's the mediator of the covenant and so on. And that's what we understand here. A prophet like Moses. This is one of the images that they're kind of trying to play on here in this part of Mark. The prophet like Moses has come, somebody that they're waiting for, a focal point of hope, and they're giving out miraculous food. He's sustaining huge numbers of people as they sit on the plain. It was meant to be something which drew eyes to him, but they still only partly comprehended who he was. They saw the bread passed around, but they did not understand yet that Jesus was the bread of life. They were only part way. They'd only understood something of the character and identity of Jesus. They're only partially understood, or maybe in some cases not seen it at all. But what these disciples failed to fully grasp from the loaves, as it says, what they'd failed to fully grasp from the feeding of the 5,000, the walking on water made much clearer for them. In this incident on the Sea of Galilee, it's like they now get a kind of supercharged version. because of the sea and the wind and the chaos that we already talked about. You remember how I said the ancients were really afraid of the sea and the symbol of power and chaos. So it's not surprising to us that in Old Testament Jewish thought, it was a mark of the divine to be able to control and contain and calm the seas. Who else could do that, as we've sung? The sea spoke of chaos, darkness and emptiness and confusion. It was a tyranny that only God could control. And so it's worth spending a moment just looking back at some of the Old Testament references to this. One of them is Psalm 77. So if you want to flick back with me to Psalm 77 and want to read just a little bit, or you can just listen if you prefer, from verse 16 down to 20, it says, Psalm 77, 16, "When the waters saw you, O God, when the waters saw you, they were afraid. Indeed, the deep trembled. The clouds poured out water. The skies gave forth thunder. Your arrows flashed on every side. The crash of your thunder was in the whirlwind. Your lightnings lighted up the world, and the earth trembled and shook. Your way was through the sea, your path through the great waters. Yet your footprints were unseen. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron." And then another one, Psalm 107, which we already read this morning, hopefully. It's almost like somebody planned it, isn't it? Psalm 107, verse 23. "Some went down to the sea in ships, doing business on the great waters. They saw the deeds of the Lord, his wondrous works in the deep, for he commanded and raised the stormy wind, which lifted up the waves of the sea. They mounted up to heaven, they went down to the depths. Their courage melted away in their evil plight. They reeled and staggered like drunken men and were at their wits' end. Then they cried to the Lord in their trouble, and he delivered them from their distress. He made the storm be still, and the waves of the sea were hushed. And then they were glad. The waters were quiet, and he brought them to their desired haven." Now, holding some of that in your head, and these guys probably knew some of these verses, didn't they? Then read back in Mark 6, verse 48. "They were making headway painfully. The wind was against them. About the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. He meant to pass by them, but when they saw him walking on the sea, they thought it was a ghost and cried out, for they all saw him and were terrified. But immediately he spoke to them and said, 'Take heart, it is I, do not be afraid.' And he got into the boat with them, and the winds ceased, and they were utterly astounded." The commentator, William Hendrickson, writes, "If they had fully understood the significance of the miraculous feeding, they would have known that it implied Christ's power to bend the material universe, including not only the product of the soil, but also the billows of the sea and the currents of the air. He could bend them to his wishes." I love that. He has the power to bend the material universe. He can bend the normal rules of this universe because he's God over it and he made it. Who else could do that? So God miraculously feeds his people in the wilderness with manna and in the feeding of the 5,000 with bread and fish. Well, why not? And God miraculously comes to his people in the storm as one who walks on water or through the waves. So that when they see Jesus walking on the water and they've got past the whole Phantom of the Opera lyrics thing, what starts to become clear in their increasingly transformed vision is a realization of the only person who this could possibly be. Only one person could be this and do this. The term Messiah had been bandied around in their thinking. It was on the lips of the crowds. But this filled the Messiah idea with more significance than ever before. Because this Messiah is not just a rabbi. He's not just a teacher. He's not just a miracle worker. He's not just a healer. He is the divine one. God come to them. So that Hebrews 12, catch this from verses 2 and 3 of Hebrews, sorry, Hebrews 1, verses 2 and 3, in the introduction to the book there, he says, "In these last days he's spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed the heir of all things, through whom he also created the world. He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature, and he upholds the universe by the word of his power." Jesus is their teacher, and he is endowed with the kind of power that they normally would only expect of the God revealed in the scriptures. But then there's more. see the words as he speaks to them in verse 50. He says, take heart, it's I, it is I, do not be afraid. And many observe that that it is I is basically the same as saying, I am. The name that the Lord uses of himself to Moses in the burning bush. I am who I am, Yahweh, the self-sustaining, ever-present one, here in human form. And so of course he can walk on the water. Of course he can. It would be weird if he couldn't, right? And so hence in a heady moment, the other Gospels tell us, Peter got out of the boat, which might appear to be insanity, or is it? Could it actually be that in that moment he was seeing more clearly than he ever had before? His vision, his spiritual eyes were being transformed. These disciples were able to see more clearly who it was they were following and what that meant for their fears. Where and how to place their trust. You know, Peter knew in that moment, as unbelievable as his actions were, he was safer in the water near Jesus than he was in the boat at the mercy of the sea. The human condition is one of spiritual myopia and the resultant hard-heartedness that comes from that. But the person of Christ is more wonderful than we imagine, and he is nothing less than the Creator in human form. Now, what does this mean as we start to wrap up? Four things briefly that we want to grasp. Don't worry, they're four short things, right? Four things to grasp. Firstly, let's grasp the importance of opening our hearts. The problem for these followers was that their hearts were hardened, and this was debilitating to them. Their understanding of reality was thrown by the material situation in front of them, as we thought. It meant they could not see what was right in front of them. That's what their hardened hearts did for them. The scope of their understanding was limited. The horizons were narrow. There's limited range, limited capacity. Our fallen hearts need training. They need time in God's presence so often to get beyond material issues. We can learn actually from what Jesus did in pausing to slow down and pray and stepping aside from the tyranny of the urgent and the immediate. You know, just tuning in to how God would have you see things. Go somewhere. Maybe do that this afternoon. Do it at some point this week. Take a walk. Get away from it all. Lock yourself in the bathroom if that's the best place to get some privacy in your household. Pray that God would soften your heart. And then here's some ways that that happens, some more things to grasp. The second thing is, grasp how Jesus the Creator knows our fears. Jesus knew exactly what was going on for these guys. It says in verse 48 that he saw them. He was up on the mountain alone, there in the middle of the lake fighting the storm, and he saw. He sees. He knows. And in fact, as one writer put it, he can use the element we fear as the path for his feet. Isn't that great? He can use the element we fear as the path for his feet. Many times he will come to you through the very event or circumstance that is so fearful to you. He knows your fears. Believe it. And here's the third thing to grasp. Grasp how much Jesus the Creator cares for us. This was arguably one of the ways in which the disciples grew in this moment. They clearly already understood that Jesus was powerful. They knew he taught and healed and did miracles like no one else, but they knew in this moment that he cared for them. He came to them in their need, and they really could depend on him. He's concerned for our welfare. He cares what happens to you. And because of this, we can know that trials, though they might be very real and painful, frightening events, they will not go on forever, and they will not ultimately win the day. Jesus cares for you. And then the fourth thing, which kind of pulls them all together, is to grasp the steadying power of faith in Jesus. The steadying power of faith in Jesus. These disciples grew in faith. And that faith is so often the counter to fear. They grew in their ability to depend on Jesus and to trust him. Their kind of faith muscle grew as they exercised it more. Faith in Christ will sustain you through anything because of who it's in. It will steady you. When you can't see the end, when you can't see the escape, whether it's in the wind and the waves, as these men were, or the crises of life, the fear of some event, a physical threat, disappointment, failure, some emotional catastrophe, whatever it may be, faith in Jesus is a steadying thing, like a rope wrapped around a rock, or an anchor in a storm, or the lighthouse in darkness, whatever other metaphor you might like to think of. Faith in Jesus holds you steady. It gives you your bearings. It enables you to trust even when you don't know what's going on, because somebody else does. We're not all adrift and alone. We're not forgotten. He's there, he's real, and he's powerful. And he has got tighter hold of you, actually, than you have of him. He sees and he knows, and he works even through that difficulty. He comes to you sometimes via the difficulty. And knowing that enables you to see with transformed eyes that this one is truly powerful and all-knowing, and he is for you. He is for you. The living God, become like one of us, knows you and is for you. Why wouldn't you open your heart to him? Don't we want and need this person in our lives? Through his death, his life and his death and his resurrection, we can really and meaningfully know him and walk with him. And so in a few moments, if the band want to come up, we're going to take the bread and the cup very shortly. And this would be a moment, wouldn't it? This would be a moment to, wherever we are in our Christian life, whether it's new experience, even something today that you're just coming to the realization of, or whether you've been a Christian for 50 years, this is a moment, isn't it, to open our hearts, to pray for soft hearts and a growing clarity of sight of who this is and the strength to be able to walk with him and keep on going. So you take the bread and the cup, you're remembering Jesus. We're celebrating him. And anybody who is a follower of Jesus here, if you're trusting him, if you're following him, you're welcome to take the bread and the cup today together. It's a moment for us to do it personally and corporately, to say, this Jesus is the one I'm following. This is the one who is the divine one. This is the one who died for me. This is the one I love. And this is the one that I am going to follow till the end of the age and on into eternity. Let's pray, shall we? Father, thank you for your love and kindness. Thank you for the way that we can trust you, even in the darkest and most fearful times, because you are there and you are real. You are near. You see us. You understand us. You know how we're wired. You know what we need in a given moment. Help us to lean hard on you. And as we take the bread and the cup in a few moments, may we lean hard on you by faith. May we trust you. Give us the sight. Soften our hearts. And enable us to trust. Because you are the only one we can come to. We love you and we thank you and we worship you.